Hi, Richard Feidler here, and thanks for downloading this special music conversation. We've had to edit the songs from this podcast in line with Australian copyright law. So if you want to track down the music and hear it in full, you can find the song track titles and artists listed on our website. Go to abc.net.au/conversations. Thank you. Go ahead and enjoy.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, the King of Pop, Normie Rowe, is my guest today. Normie Rowe was Australia's biggest pop star at a time when being a pop star meant that if you went out in public, you would literally create a riot in the streets. Normie Rowe did more than that. He led the way for a whole generation of Australian singers who dominated the charts from the mid-60s to the 70s. And Normie's life is emblematic of his generation. It combines all that lovely delirious madness of 60s pop music and the horror of the Vietnam War, which left its mark on Normie as it did on so many people. When Normie Rowe returned from Vietnam, the pop world had moved on and found something else to scream about, but the songs remain as raw and exciting as ever, and it's my enormous honour and privilege to say, Normie Rowe, welcome to Conversation, sir.
It's my enormous pleasure to be here, I've got to say, Richard. Thank you very much.
I had a lot of fun doing the research into the show because I got to play a lot of your old hits, a lot of the stuff that hasn't, that people don't remember so well. They remember your big hits.
Scary, aren't they?
No, they're so good. They're so great. Like, and I want to play a few of them today. Like, if people remember Que Sera Sera, and they remember Shaken All Over, and a whole lot of other songs. But I found some other stuff that's in your back catalogue, which is just great. Where are those songs? Are they out on disc? Because I got some of them on YouTube.
Well, there's about 60-odd on one compilation. 63, I think, on a compilation from Warner Brothers called Normie Rowe and the Playboys, an early anthology. Then there are quite a few more that are included on another set called It Ain't Necessarily
Rowe.
So, no. Is Rowe, is it?
Yeah, I think that was one of your earlier EPs,
wasn't it? Necessarily So,
yeah.
Normie Rowe, a definitive collection. And between the two of them, it's got probably 80%, you know. So there's around about 80 or 90 tracks out there in the marketplace, which is, you know, astonishes even me. I don't know where we had the time to go and record.
Well, that's
them.
Right. You mustn't have slept at all. The other thing I have to watch after is ask you after having seen those old YouTube clips is who is your tailor? Because you look so sharp in them. You were a really classic 60s mod in those days.
I've got to say I was inspired by the stars, my idols, people like Johnny O'Keefe, but more closely associated with people like Johnny Chester from Melbourne, who was a really neat dresser, you know, English mohair suits, and Bobby Cookson, and Colin Cook was a suave, young, beautiful-looking man, you know, big blue eyes that you could swim in, you know, and this wonderful voice, and just so sartorially splendid.
Just sharp as all get out. Were you inspired by Tom Jones as well? Because Tom Jones from that period had great suits, and Ray Davies from the Kinks and those guys. Were they not in your radar at that
point? We were already doing it before Tom Jones really sort of hit his straps. Certainly the Beatles were dressed beautifully, you know. When I got to the UK in 66, I think it was, my manager, David Joseph, at the time, took me down to Savile Row and said, you must dress, you know, accordingly. And being on tour with people like Gene Pitney, who was once again sartorially splendid, he was an inspiration. And of course, Johnny O'Keefe, to the day he passed over, and made all his noise upstairs was he was just impeccable with his clothing. You know, Billy Thorpe and Ray Brown and of course, Tony Worsley and the Blue Jays all had, they had exceptional dress sense in those days.
You're a Northcote boy. You grew up in Northcote in Melbourne.
Mm-hmm.
Working class?
Oh, very much so. I in hindsight, I realised that we were the lower edge of middle class, I suppose. Well, it's probably the middle of the... Dad never earned any more than the basic wage until the day he died.
Were you conscious that you were a lower income family?
Absolutely not. I had a fantastic upbringing. I remember just beautiful times when I was a little kid. I'm quite sure that I was either a mistake.
Because, why?
Well, there was my brother and sister who were about 2 years apart, and then another 7 years for me. I think I might have been an oops.
And a word for that night of passion. There's a whole chapter of Australian pop history that would not be told.
Exactly. Yes. But it was.
So you don't really know what you're doing when you do these things.
You know, my mother was a wonderful singer. You know, and she sang from the time she got out of bed until the time she went to bed at night. And she was a beautiful singer. I can still hear her in my head. Of the Patsy Cline and Kitty Callan and, you know, Doris Day and those sort of people. You know, she had this beautiful voice, and she was one of 10 kids. I think there were two brothers and the rest were sisters, and they all went to a place in Melbourne called the May Downs Dancing Academy or whatever it was at that time. But it's still going today, the same dancing school. And had it not been for the end of the First World War, the Great Depression, and I guess the Second World War, I'm sure that at least one of the sisters and probably my mother would have been... you know, treading the boards for a lot of her time.
Did you have a musical education?
Yes, I did. I desperately wanted to learn to play guitar. Desperately. I'd read the back of these comic books and learn to play the guitar in six easy lessons and things like that. And
what an earnest kid. The rest of us were trying to get those X-ray specs instead.
Yes. Yes. Or the 3D things.
Yeah.
And I found out that I could go and have lessons at the Victoria Banjo Club, and there were about 50 other guitar players. It took half the lesson for the teacher to wander around and tune everybody's guitar up so that we could get some semblance of order.
How did you start performing? Do you remember how young you were? Because you were young when
you first got there. I was actually a little 2 or 3 year old when I first leapt up onto a stage and just surprised everybody, and I'd go out to these social functions with mum and dad and go and look at the band, and of course the band was a modern band of drums, piano and saxophone, and I'd just sit there and watch these people for the whole night, and then I just got up one day and I sang Popeye the Sailor Man. I was about 2 or 3 and I, I'm Popeye the Sailor Man, poof, I'm Popeye. And everybody said, oh, how cute. And I liked it. I think that was the beginning of it. Then every time somebody switched the light on, I was out there going, ta-da.
How did you become a singer? Singer, who was Stan the Man Rofe, the legendary Melbourne DJ, was instrumental in that. How did he approach you? Tell me about that.
I was doing a concert at the Moomba Festival in Melbourne on the back of a truck. It was organised by the Lutapano Music School, where I'd gone from the banjo club to the Lutapano Music School, and they taught music proper.
And how old were you then?
12.
12, or right.
12. Yeah. And by the time I got on stage, I was about 12. I had to tell everybody I was 14 to get on stage at the Preston Town Hall. And Stan introduced me to the promoter, and I started singing there every Saturday night.
What did he say to you? He asked you.
Yeah, he gave me a couple of. Well, he put me up on the stage first of all, and I sang the songs. of my idol Johnny Chester, saying, you know, Summertime Blues and Shaken All Over, which was John's big hit in Melbourne at the time, a cover of Johnny Kidd and the Pirates. And it was quite exciting for me because the band I was actually singing with was the band who recorded the backing for Johnny Chester. It wasn't the Chessmen, it was the Thunderbirds. And I got to sing with the Thunderbirds. I mean, you know, I could die now. Heaven had already surpassed me, you know, or I'd surpassed it. And so it was the most exciting time, you know. It was for a kid, just at high school. And then, and I remember Trotter, who became the drummer of the Playboys, he was then the drummer of Johnny Chester's band, the Chessmen, and he'd come around to high school in his Zephyr and pick me up from high school and take me to rehearsal. And I remember I was the first time I went to rehearsal with Johnny Chester and the Chessmen, and I was watching in awe. I mean, I couldn't even speak. I was in the company of, you know.
That's so cool. I think that's great. Isn't that fantastic to have your biggest pop idol as a guy from the same town as you?
I mean,
you could do that in those days. I mean, it's not, and yeah.
Funnily enough, they lived just down the street from Bert Newton too, and the guys from the Chessmen. And I went there and all of a sudden Chester said, "We'll take it from the middle eight." What's the middle eight? And I hung on every one of these, you know, little terms, and you know, it was such a great learning period for me too. But
what advice did Stan the man Rofe give you?
He said to me at the end of the first night, we went home and we sat in the car for about 10 minutes, and he said, "Now look, two words of advice. The first one is never believe any publicity written about you. Never believe it, okay? Keep your feet on the ground. And the other one is, if you don't make it by the time you're 19, it won't be too late." And I went, "What? 19? I'll be an old man." It was incredible. And 19? Oh, no. I will only have 2 years because nobody's ever heard of a 21-year-old rock star.
Your first big hit was "It Ain't Necessarily So." Yeah. I'm going to play that in just a moment. This is a George Gershwin's song. How old were you when you recorded that? Before, you were younger than 19, weren't you?
Well, I was truly. I think I was about just turned 17.
17. Mm. And how did you pick that? That's a really interesting song to pick.
Stan Rofe gave us a whole pile. Stan was fantastic with all of us, and he nurtured the Australian music scene very, very much with stuff that he'd gleaned from overseas. You know,
This is a Paul Robeson song, you know, and to turn it into rock and roll was kind of great.
There was a band in the UK who made the effort to change it a bit, and some of that remained with our arrangement. And then we had a guy who was working at Cloudland here at the time. His name is Patrick Alton, and one of the most beautiful men you'd ever met. And Pat became our record producer. And he came down to Melbourne and he said, "Right, now what we need to do, instead of playing this all the way through in the same key, we're going to modulate it at the end of each verse, and it'll get build bigger and bigger, and we're going to have vocal backings, and what we came to know later on through Phil Spector was this wall of sound." But Pat had never heard the wall of sound yet. "You've Lost That Love and Feeling" hadn't really hit at this stage. So it's amazing how the same thing can happen at either side of the world. And then you say, "Oh, well, he did it first and he copied it," or "He did it first and he copied it." But the thing is that...
Time is right for this sound.
Yeah.
Here it is. This is Normie Rowe's first great hit single, "It Ain't Necessarily So."
It ain't necessarily so. It ain't necessarily so. The things that you're liable to read in the Bible ain't necessarily so. Mm-hmm.
Normie Rowe's beautiful tenor voice on that version of It Ain't Necessarily So.
Boy's voice.
It's great. It begins, it's so spare in the opening. It's got all that air and atmosphere, and then it becomes bigger and bigger, as you say, and you can hear the more of the organ and the choral voices in it. That's great. Tell me the story about the drummer who was the drummer in that recording.
Trotter. Yeah, well, Trot was the drummer with, as I said, Johnny Chester and the Chessmen. And when they split up, this band was formed, and we did our rehearsals, and we had Marcy Jones was with the band too. She was the girl singer, and I was the boy singer, and we had all our repertoire sorted out. We were just about to go on stage, and the promoter Kevin McClelland said, "What are we going to call you?" And I went, "Oh, we forgot about a name." And Helen, Kevin's wife, said, "Well, you're nothing but a bunch of playboys, so just call yourself for that."
Bingo. That. Fantastic.
Yeah.
So it was Normie Rowe and the Playboys from then on.
And Trotter,
where is Trotter today?
Living in Melbourne about a year ago, we dragged him out of mothballs. He was doing not a lot. And I said, "Come on, you're going to play." "Oh, I don't want to play anymore." I said, "Yeah, you come and play. You can do it." So now we just did 2 weeks in Melbourne, and we did 12 shows. And
is he enjoying it?
Loves it. He loves it, and I love it too. It's the most joy I've had on stage for so many years. Just to watch, you know, between Steve, my piano player, and I, we've unleashed a maniac for
right.
a start.
Yeah.
But he's got the best chops, you know. For listeners who don't understand. Don't talk the
he
our
plays
jargon.
Beautifully. He plays
He's
beautifully.
Got these skills that drummers don't tend to have these days, because he was brought up in a Salvation Army band.
Family. So he plays traditional grip then?
So, yeah, he's got traditional grip, and he's got beautiful wrists, really supple wrists, and he's got these wonderful. You listen to in Shaken All Over. We're going to play that, are we?
Yeah, we certainly are.
Well, when we play that, listen to the drum solo and this wonderful stuff that you will never hear on any record. It doesn't even matter if you're Liberty DeVito.
Normie Rowe was my guest in conversation. That song made you a major star, and then hit after hit after hit after hit. Were you ready for that? Were you ready for the kind of... pop stars get a lot of attention these days, but in the mid-60s, to be a pop star was insane, absolutely insane. Were you... You can't be ready for that, can you, the kind of things
that happen? I don't think so, but I had really... really good people around me.
What did it take for you to get out the door, Normie? I mean, seriously, once you were that big a star, to get out of your house?
You know, no big deal. It was no big deal. Whenever I came into a town, I'd go down to the Coles or Woolies. You remember the old Coles and Woolies where you'd walk, it's sort of five and dime. I used to go down, not like a supermarket is today, and I'd go down to that to feel a little bit of home. Because everywhere you went, there was Coles and Woolworths.
Why wouldn't they go, "Oh, there's Normie Rowe," scream, tear your clothes?
That looks, no, it couldn't be. He wouldn't be out there. And it was wonderful. I could walk around anywhere. And I just don't get all these people who are the paparazzi. And if you don't want the paparazzi around you, give them your time. Don't be so exclusive. And, you know, in 5 minutes, they'll have had enough and they'll leave you alone.
You had a huge hit with this double single here. This was a double A-side, I think, wasn't it? Breaking Point and Ya Ya. I'm going to play Ya Ya because I was playing it this morning and my 8-year-old daughter started dancing to it. It's a great little...
Very funny song.
We used to
have some... do silly things with these songs. But
this is you at your raw early stage. Like, I can hear this kind of... It's kind of raw mod music. It's rock and roll, and
I had this idea of a bit cutesy, you know, being cute to the audience, and because I know that it got a reaction, and I built on that. I'm a bit embarrassed to say it these days, but it was a bit.
Yeah, it's perfect party music as far as I'm concerned. I really dig this man.
Oh, I know. Hit it.
I dig this man. Normie Rowe and the Playboys with Ya Ya from 1966.
Oh, well, I'm
sitting here, la la, waiting for my yaya. Ow, ow. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Sensational. There you go. That is Yaya, Normie Rowe and the Playboys there from 1966. Sounds a little bit like Booker T and the MG. Sounds, oh, it just sounds great. That's fantastic. That'd fill up a dance floor today, I reckon, Normie.
Yeah, would it?
I don't know. But yeah. It's certainly got my old house grooving this morning, that's for sure. It's not doof music, but it's got a great groove to it. What do you remember of recording that? Because you sound so loose and so tight at the same time. The band's really tight, but you're clearly having a party in the studio.
Had mono machines. You know, there was one track, so and four channel mixer. So basically, we recorded the band, and then we would bounce that at the same time, record one of the vocals or
right. So you're sitting there hearing it in your cans,
yeah, and hearing it off the tape, and I'm recording my vocal onto, and that'll go through the mix, and we could add another four things or three things at the same time back onto another mono. Surprisingly enough, the problem we had was a thing called generation loss, which meant that every time you did this bouncing thing, you lost a bit of tape quality.
Ah, the old analog technology, yes.
And which is now, they have digital machines that add it in.
I know. Yes, that's amazing. You actually have digital machines to give it that kind of analog quality now.
Exactly, yeah.
That's amazing, isn't it? Normally, in that time, you sold, in the mid-60s onwards, you sold more 45s and EPs, probably enough to pave one end of Australia to the other. It was vast amounts of vinyl were shifted with your name on it.
Yeah, what's really, really a great compliment is people come to my shows with these vinyls and ask me to sign them for the first time. Of course, I'll sit down and sign as long as people want me to, you know. But
did it make you rich? Were you rich for a while?
No. No, I went into the army. I was really broke, and then the taxation department came along because I wasn't getting paid very much.
I mean, before all that happened, at that time, were you wealthy? Were you living high off the hog at that point?
No. I think I was being paid around about $50 a week to do what I was doing. I had no idea of what sort of money was coming in through the door at the concerts and
someone was making a lot of money off you then.
And I didn't receive any royalties at all until after I came back from Vietnam. And the taxation department sent me a bill for $100,000 and I went, I'm going to jail. $100,000, I couldn't even perceive what $100,000 looked like. I'd certainly never seen money in the $1,000 lots, and so it all came down to the record company accountants had done some pretty creative stuff, and I ended up with a $17,000 tax bill. Because this wonderful solicitor in Melbourne, Roger Kirby, is an elderly man, and he took me aside and he was a real mentor, you know, and he said, look, you know, we're going to have to go in and sort out something and you'll have to pay. And I paid out that bill from army pay. For the 2 years I was in the army, I didn't actually spend any money. And I had one of the reasons I had to go to Vietnam was because I got more money being in a war zone than I did if I stayed. So at the end of my time in the army, I paid out my bills, and I came out and I was clear and free.
What a way to pay your tax bill, Normie. You went to the UK after success, hit after hit after hit in Australia, and you must have. Was that like starting from scratch, going to the UK?
Yeah, it was. I had some skills, but my God, you know, these people were streets ahead of what we were doing in Australia. You know, we've caught up. We caught up 30 years ago. But in those days, you know, we were still, we'd only just got our first, I recorded the first stereo album ever recorded in Australia. It was called So Much Love. And that album was recorded on an Ampex four-track machine.
Four-track?
Four-track. I got to England and they'd had an Ampex four-track machine for a long time. And in fact, we still used it to record It's Not Easy. But they had this monstrous Neve desk, huge, I don't know how many channels, but lots and lots of channels. And I walked into the studio to record. The first thing I did was Ooh La La. And it was the Ted Heath Band, the Breakaways, and the Ivy League with a vocal backing. And the rhythm section was John Paul Jones, a bass player of Led Zeppelin later on, and Jimmy Page.
Jimmy Page, John Paul Jones from Led Zeppelin, are playing in the background of...
Clem Cattini on drums. Clem ended up playing on 42 UK number one records, including It's Not Unusual and all of Dusty stuff. And
but
all
but you've got two members of Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to hear this now. This is Normie Rowe singing It's Not Easy. A couple of guys from Led Zeppelin in the background.
Hey girl, what can I do with you when you take this old heart and tear it in two? Is it asking so much for you to be true?
Normie Rowe singing It's Not Easy. What a great song. Who wrote that song, Normie?
Barry Mann, Cynthia Weil, who wrote You've Lost That Love and Feeling, Soul and Inspiration. Part wrote with Dan Hill, Sometimes When We Touch, and a plethora of other extraordinary songs.
What, Jimmy Page from Led Zeppelin playing session music on the guitar on that.
Just
what
the chops.
Just the chops. What do you remember of him showing up? Because he was a bit of a square in those days, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, he and John Paul Jones arrived and Page Boy haircut.
this is before the Yardbirds, isn't it? Before the Yardbirds, yeah.
Yeah. Three-piece suit. The Yardbirds, I think, was Clapton at that time for a very brief time. Brief period, and I think Jeff Beck was, because I used to go to see them down at the Marquee Club in London. I got to tell you, you'll love this one. I met Otis Redding backstage at the Tiles Club, and another guy walked in, and I looked around as Tom Jones, and we all sat down. I've got this wonderful photo, compliments of my manager at the time, Richie York. Who I don't know where how he kept this photograph, but it's a photograph of Tom Jones, Otis Redding, and me. And but we used to go and see Ike and Tina Turner Review at these clubs, and so many wonderful people, it was unbelievable to live in London in those days. It was right in the middle of Carnaby Street and the Beatles mania thing that was going on, and the beginning of the Haight-Ashby thing in
San Francisco.
Thing, whatever it's called, in San Francisco.
And, so you were there in the right place at the right time.
Absolutely.
All that period, and then you weren't. Then you were conscripted. You were conscripted, and you were... Now, there's been some confusion about whether your number did come up or not.
It Vietnam. Didn't come up the first time round, but I wasn't here for it. I was still in England and just finishing off recordings and everything like that. I was already committed, you know. It's interesting. I've got some of the best friends that any man could ever have because of my time in the army. So I would never negate that. But I think the way that government over the many years has treated veterans, I think if I'd known that in advance, I probably would have stayed in England. I think government, you know, this government is hideous towards vets, you know. But
I think the whole country wasn't great to Vietnam vets for a very long time.
For a very long time, yeah. It wasn't until the Welcome Home Parade. And that's wrong. This is how I view music. When John Schumann and his band Red Gum recorded Only 19, I don't know that they could ever realise what they might have started. But with that record, it really threw the light on the plight of veterans, especially, you know, Frankie kicked the mine the day that mankind kicked the moon. What a great line. A fantastic lyric. And that song, from these boys who probably 10 years earlier were, you know, raging against the machine, had written this song that became, it's immortalised now because those lines are actually on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Canberra. And rightly so, because I think without that song, we may still have been languishing. It was the catalyst, and from that came the impetus and a couple of ideas of having a welcome home parade from six young, at that stage, veterans who'd been to America to see their first welcome home parade, came back with the idea, and off we went, and we had this magnificent event in 87. And that was the beginning of an immense healing that was to take place and still is taking place today.
What strikes me from that time, Normie, is the change in you. You know, your life is kind of champagne up until this point. Well, sorry, your life as a pop star is just fizzy, joyous, fantastic colour, fun, music, girls, all of that, and friends, joy, and then there's this. And very, very quickly you became, you know, by all accounts, a very serious guy, a very
you can't go
guy.
To war and not be changed. I'm noticing the difference in Sally Sara, who's the ABC reporter, who is in the Middle East at the moment. I'm watching her, and I see the change. She's becoming a very, very substantial human being. I don't think it's bad. I just think it's different. Your life road changes, and
we've
because
all noticed
you
that too,
because
Norman.
You see the grief, you see the misery and the sadness, the things that that politics and greed drive, and the losers are not the people who do the driving. You know, it's they're the people who, after all, really only want to live and see their families grow and be part of their local community.
I want to play a little bit of a song from another artist, Ronnie Byrne, singing Smiley, because it's about you. Johnny Young wrote it. It's about you. It's and knowing that it becomes, you know, really moving. Here's a little bit of Smiley.
Smiley, you're out in the world today. Smiley, you're all on your own.
Smiley, there you are. You're off to the Asian War. That is Ronnie Byrne singing Smiley, which was written about you, Normie. What did you think when you heard that? Did you know it was about you?
No. In fact, I was, I guess it was around 1990, I was doing a radio program on 4BH, and John came in, and John Young came in, and we were sitting there, and we started playing some of the songs. John has such a huge body of work that people don't realise.
Yeah, the real thing, Russell Morris, you know, many, many, many other songs too. Yeah.
I thank you. Just lots and lots of stuff. And John said to me, you know, I wrote that about you. And I said, really? And he said, Ronnie came to me and he said, will you write me a song about the Vietnam War? And he said, my only experience with the Vietnam War was you going off to it. And so I wrote about you. And I went, wow, thank you for that compliment.
You didn't hear that because you were in Vietnam. Is that what happened? Or what?
I think it was released in
1960. How did you not know that was about you? That's amazing. How did you not know? It's so clearly about you.
I think it was recorded in 1969, right, when I was in Vietnam.
Yeah.
I bury my head in the sand a fair bit, you know, every now and then. There's a song I recorded in England called Going Home, which would have been a perfect song to sing for Vietnam War, and it never occurred to me. I just looked at it and thought, you know, this song was so reminiscent of a young man leaving his family and going off to the war and coming back a very, very different person. And of course, by that time, I'd experienced the changes not only in myself but in my mates, you know, and still very young men. When I look at the photographs of us in Vietnam, you look and say, who would send these kids? They look like they're barely out of primary school. And when you think about it, you know, 7 or 8 years after primary school, they're in a war. It's pretty sad.
After Vietnam, you've spoken about this many times in the past. There's dreadful things happened after that. You lost a son, several marriages, the problems with all sorts of aspects of your life, and post-traumatic stress disorder, which really only came to the head in, 2001, I think?
Yeah, pretty much. It had raised its ugly head a few times before, but, I didn't know what it was. I just felt depressed and had anxiety. I couldn't sleep and all sorts of things, bad dreams and everything.
But the days where you couldn't get out of bed?
Absolutely. In 2001, I had a major crash that was precipitated by a relationship breakdown. And the stress of that, and I tried to commit suicide. And two of my mates grabbed me, took me to the doctor, got a referral, and took me to a clinic and said, you're going to have to look after him. And I was in fetal position for 6 weeks. I just couldn't move. I was just debilitated. And it was the most horrible feeling, you know. I just excruciating pains in the stomach, and that were not caused by, you know, a physiological thing. It was all psychological.
That's so common. That's so common to feel that awful, awful pain. I've interviewed other people, Vietnam veterans, who have experienced physical, real physical pain.
Yeah.
That comes from this trauma.
It's like half a dozen cook's knives being thrust into your stomach and then twisted. You know, it's just an awful feeling. And then my psychiatrist said to me, I'd like you to see my colleague who specialises in post-traumatic stress disorder. And I said, I don't have PTSD. I didn't see all that much stuff in Vietnam. And he said, humour me. And I thought, well, he's got a great sense of humour. I'll go along with it. And then we did this test, and there was only one symptom out of, I think it was 18 or 20 symptoms of PTSD that I didn't have, and that was a huge drinking problem. I just didn't really have a drinking problem. I'd do a bit of a binge drink every now and then, but, you know, not every night, and I wasn't what you would call a fully blown alcoholic by any stretch. So he said, yeah, well, we'd like to treat you. And they put me into this course with a few other veterans, and the stories that came out from them, all the stories were very different, because you weren't at the sharp end per se, because you weren't maybe the scout or in infantry, didn't preclude you from suffering PTSD. Every person completely unique. There were varying degrees of unique, every person had their own version of this thing.
Do you get?
But if I can just say this one thing, so that because it may help some other people, you don't have to have been on the show on the front line. If you had a subconscious perception that at any moment you could be killed for any length of time over a six-month period, 24 hours a day over a six-month period, you will suffer PTSD for the rest of your life. End of story, and that's all there is to it. So there are a lot of misconceptions about war-related trauma, PTSD as it relates to that. But as a rule of thumb, you will have this thing, you'll suffer hypervigilance, sometimes it can work for you. At the end of the day, though, you will need strategies to deal with it, and they are now at hand, thank God. And so if you do suffer from this, and you don't have to have been in a war, you can pick it up somewhere else, go and see your GP and go and see a psychologist, go and see a psychiatrist, whatever, and get some help.
You've had an extremely eventful life, Normie, extremely eventful. And all those things that, you know, I look at those film clips of you as a young guy, and you're young, you've got all that energy, and it's fabulous. And then I found this, which is you singing from your time in Les Miserables, in the lead role of Jean Valjean. And this is you singing Bring Him Home. And this is a different man singing this song. This is a man who's had real ups and downs in his life and dreadful tragedy and trauma. And it's very powerful. It's very, very powerful to hear this. It's a bad recording, unfortunately, but I really want to play it because it's very, very powerful hearing you sing this song. This is you from sometime in the mid-80s, I think it is, mid to late 80s, singing the song Bring Him Home from Les Miserables. That's Normie Rowe singing Bring Him Home from Les Miserables. That's very powerful. That was a real showstopper, and you can hear the audience almost losing their mind.
That was on Queensland Day at Expo.
Tell me what someone said after they heard you sing that.
Claude Michel Schoenberg, who was the writer of the music, said to my agent, when it was announced that I was going to be doing this role, and I'd been in rehearsal for some time, and he said, June... And if you're listening, June, I love you. June, you know, it's like Normie, he sings his song like he has been in a war or he has lost a son. And June said, well, he's done both of those things. And he said, it's no wonder. He is Valjean.
Amen to that. Normie, it's been great having you in conversation. They've been wanting to do it for so long, and it's been great going over this amazing back catalogue of your songs and records. You're a bit of a national treasure, and it's been such a pleasure to have you in conversation with
us. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.